shot by Palestinian farmer Ahmad Burnat, who brought his first camera in 2005 to record the birth of his youngest son. The film is structured in chapters around the destruction of each one of Burnat's cameras. Again, that's Five Broken Cameras, Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It's 11 o'clock, and get ready for the Dirt Bag. Glenn Andreessen is here with Tim Wessels and Tom Chester from various beekeeping organizations, and the topic is beekeeping today. So, and I think they're inviting calls, as usual. Okay. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Also by Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver, available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. And also by One Green World, a nursery offering hard-to-find fruiting plants designed to help you grow your own food and decorate your yard, deck, or patio. Now located in Portland at 6469 Southeast 134th. For a color catalog, the number is 1-877-353-4028 or online at onegreenworld.com.
Good morning. We've reached the second Wednesday of the month. It's time for the Dirt Bag. Good morning. This is Glenn Andreessen here beside you now until 12 noon. We won't be talking so much about digging and farming today, but we will be talking about beekeeping. Yes, it's the third annual beekeeping edition where we talk about bees and beekeeping. And the other side of beekeeping, flowering plants for bees, for this hour. In the studio with me are two distinguished gentlemen from two distinguished organizations. On my left here is Tom Chester, representing the Portland Metro Beekeeping Association. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
And across from me is Tim Wessels, the president and an outgoing president, I guess we will say, of the Portland Urban Beekeepers. He's a founding member of that group, and now he's stepping down from the leadership position there. Tim Wessels, welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Glenn.
Tim has been on before, and we will talk. We'll have lots of updates today and find out how you can, if you're thinking about becoming a beekeeper, what some first steps might be. We will also have a plant of the month, and it's a doozy. For this time of year, it's just a great bee plant, and it's very attractive, and it's blooming now. Maybe like that. And we will also, at the half past the hour, have a garden stumper question that has to do with bees. So, a full time here. Well, let's see. What do we want to start with here? Let's just start. Let's just briefly talk about these beekeeping organizations and what someone has to do to be a part of that. Tim,
sure.
Well, start with that about the Portland Urban Beekeepers. That you know, what differentiates the two first of all.
Okay. Well, that's a great question. A lot of people ask that, new beekeepers. Well, which club, which organization should I go to? Well, it's mostly geographical. That if you're in the urban parts of Portland, then Portland Urban Beekeepers Pub is probably the best bet, because we meet right over by the Lloyd Center, and we're located in right in the inner city next to the Rose Quarters there. And we deal with primarily with things that have to do with urban settings. You know, we have people that have very tiny backyards, and, you know, generally some beekeepers that we know that even have bees on top of on porches and back porches on condos. So it's you know, I think that's one of the things we're in. The other organization around is a little more rural. The other thing is probably that ours is, we don't generally use the word club, but we do have a social aspect to what we do as an organization. And in fact, we just had our second annual honey tasting last month, which was really fun. And next month we'll have our Products of the Hive, or our pub showcase, which will be our second year we've done that.
And I just want to interject here on the honey tasting, because I did take part in that. And these were honeys from the local beekeepers. It's not that we're tasting, you know, Tupelo honey or Manuka honey from, where's that from, New Zealand?
New Zealand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So all local ones, and we had, more than 2 dozen varieties to taste, and it was surprisingly different, even though they're mostly from the city of Portland, but, or the Portland metro area.
Yeah, it was interesting, because actually one of the winners was somebody that takes their bees, they're in Portland, but they take their bees to the carrot seed.
Right.
Down in Madras, but yeah, it's interesting to see the variety and the flavors and the distinguished. We members were able to taste and test the different honeys, and by the end of the night, everybody was buzzing around like a bee.
Yeah, that's the social aspect of it that you were talking about.
But the educational part is really big. Just in the last year, we've established an education and outreach director, and this is really interesting for our group, in that we are having our first annual bee school this year, of which Glenn, you will be the instructor for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's on February 22nd, and that's, you know, a good 4 to 5 hours of classroom and academic information about bees and beekeeping. And then there'll be a second date further in the spring, when the bees are flying, where the class students will be able to go and visit one of the apiaries, most likely probably one of yours, Glenn, or one of ours. But so that's one of the things that we're excited about, is the education. And for most beekeepers that are starting out, we always recommend that they get a good book. You know, there's several out there. I always like First Lessons in Beekeeping by Keith Delaplane. And the one that we're using kind of in association with our bee school this year is The Idiot's Guide to Beekeeping. And it doesn't necessarily mean you're an idiot,
no.
but the good thing about this is that you couple that with the classes, and then, as you and I were talking, Glenn, that once you get your hands in the hive and start working with the bees, then you start really learning.
That's right. Tom,
all right.
What's you're here, you're part of you attend both groups, is that right?
That's right. I'm a member of both beekeeping organizations. Portland, I want to also mention before we get further that Portland has a third beekeeping organization, the Tualatin Valley Beekeepers, that meets the fourth Tuesday of the month in downtown Hillsboro at the OSU Ag Extension office. And so for those listeners who are in that part of town and who might be interested in attending a beekeeping group, that is a fine organization. And you can find out about all three of these organizations by going to the Oregon State Beekeepers Association main website. That's orsba.org, and it lists the various clubs, not only in the Portland area,
right,
but also in the across the state.
And since we being KBOO here, have translators in Hood River area and Corvallis area, you can find out about those local groups there.
That's
too.
That's right. But beekeeping, I keep bees not so much because of the honey. I don't eat very much honey. I keep bees because I really am fascinated by the social insects and because I like people. And one of the social one of the real benefits of keeping bees is the organizations like the Portland Urban Beekeepers and the Portland Metro Beekeepers. It's a place to get together and learn about bees. Each of the organizations has a program monthly, most every month, that to learn something about more about the intricacies of keeping bees. But a good measure of how interesting beekeeping is you'll find that even if an organization doesn't happen to have a particular program, people still come. They want to come to be able to talk about their bees, mm-hmm. to be able to engage in it. I mean, I've been involved in many things through my adult life, and that one, beekeeping is so interesting on that. This is next year will be my 20th season of keeping bees, and both of these organizations, I'm a member of both, as I said, the Portland Urban Beekeepers and the Portland Metro Beekeepers. And if it weren't so far to go out to Hillsboro, I would join that one too. Used to lived in San Francisco and kept bees there for many years, and I was a member of three other beekeeping uh-huh. organizations at that time. And each one has a different feel, and you learn something. As with the Portland Urban Beekeepers, the Portland Metro is a bit geographic, although I live in Portland and I participate mainly in the Portland Metro Beekeepers. Their meetings are held at Clackamas Community College, and they meet the second Thursday of the month, and that is this Thursday.
That's tomorrow, is it not?
Day after tomorrow. Tomorrow. This is our, we also believe in socialization is an important part of that organization, and tomorrow, rather than a program, we're having our annual holiday potluck. Uh-huh. And so whereas Portland Urban Beekeepers had a honey tasting, we're having a potluck. We're getting together, sharing food and conversation, sort of the essence of conviviality. And, of course, we're going to be having a gift exchange. We're going to be having door prizes of beekeeping stuff. And both organizations are about the same size. In addition to we too are going to be having our beginning beekeeping class. We're going to be having it on Saturday, the 21st of February, and it's going to be conducted through Clackamas Community College as part of their community education program. And so those listeners who would be interested in participating can join that. The Portland Metro Beekeepers also, as does PUB, supports the continuing education of its members through workshops. We've had workshops throughout the year, maybe on ways to raise queens or how to deal with bee diseases or how to divide colonies or how to prevent swarming, those sorts of things. One of the things I think it's important to emphasize is that in an introduction to beekeeping class, you don't a student doesn't really learn how to keep bees. A student learns the first steps in beginning to learn about keeping bees. Beekeeping is like chess. It's deceptively simple. But it's there's many much complexities, and there's a real difference between having bees. There are people who have bees, but being able to keep them and to keep them alive is difficult. But it's what makes it so fascinating. It's like playing chess with nature. I too, as with Tim, recommend if somebody is interested in books, interested in learning to keep bees, that they get a basic book. There are many books out right now, but The First Lessons in Beekeeping is good. Penn State has one that we're going to be using in our beekeeping class. Beekeeping Basics is a good one that you can even download it from the Penn State website, or you can buy it for about $10. I also recommend for somebody to just get a feel about the art and the craft and the history of beekeeping. Sue Hubbell's famous book, A Book of Bees, and that's Hubbell, H-U-B-B-E-L-L. Mm-hmm. And it's such a wonderful book. It's in print, and it's also at the library.
Well, that's in so that's the Portland Metro Beekeepers and the Portland Urban Beekeepers. Yeah, they're similar, but that just has to do with the geographic of where we are. So,
right.
So be it. So, you know, we can learn. You can learn a lot by reading, and you can learn a lot by attending these bee classes. But eventually, you learn by doing with beekeeping. There's just no other. There's no substitute for getting your hands full of propolis and stings.
That's right. You've got to open your hive. You've got to take your stings. I'll be the coordinator of the class, the Portland Metro class, and I encourage people to start with between 2 and 6 hives. It gives you more than 6 is probably too many. If you have one. You learn twice as much by having 2 hives as opposed to 1. And although the internet is a really good source of information, there is such a huge amount of information that it's easy to be overwhelmed. And I like to tell the people who take my classes that the internet is not your friend. It's more confusing, and it's important just focus on 1 or 2 books and get some principles down to learn how the bishop moves or the queen or the knight, and then to work with that. And then as you learn more, then you can begin to explore on the internet. Otherwise, it becomes a distraction. And also there is the trap of people becoming more interested in learning about beekeeping on the internet as opposed to actually opening their hives and dealing with the reality of bees and the challenges of keeping bees.
I'll generalize here that when I say a lot of what we might read online are from, I might say, newbies or pretty inexperienced but excited, and rightly so, beekeepers who will write about their experiences, and it may be an anomaly that they had this result by doing this, and it may not, but after you have kept bees for a few more years, 6 or 8 or 10, then you kind of know what patterns are and really how bees respond to stimuli, and whether that's your stimuli or the natural ones.
That's right.
One of the things that I always tell our newer beekeepers is that, there is a lot, like you were saying, Glenn, a lot of the more anecdotal stuff. I saw this happen, so this must be what they always do.
Yeah.
And what I always try to encourage with our apprentices, we work with the Oregon State University on the Master Beekeeping Program, and just to make sure that it's peer-reviewed science, preferably, ideally, and then that there is some facts that are, college-based or university-based studies that kind of back up some of these things.
One of the reasons that beekeeping is so complicated is that these are wild animals, and we're keeping these wild animals in a structure of our own so that we can manipulate them, but they really are wild animals. And It's quite complex. There have been 2 magazines, for example, published on beekeeping at least once a month in this country for nearly 150 years, or about 150 years, and they still have something new to say every month. Having bees is not hard. Keeping bees is really, really hard. The person who knows the most about beekeeping sometimes is the second-year beekeeper before he or she realizes how a big bear could get in such a little hole.
Like a teenager, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll be back to talk with Tom Chester and Tim Wessels after this break. All of our music this morning has to do with honey, because, of course, honey comes from bees. And first one is from Cold Blood, from their second album, First Taste of Sin, All My Honey. Ooh.
That's a jam there.
Lydia Pence, Cold Blood, All My Honey. Okay, let's go to the phones. I forgot to give the phone number if you have any questions about beekeeping. Or, you know, you think anything might be related to that. 503-231-8187. Okay, we've got Paul. Good morning, Paul. You're with the Dirtbag.
So someone asked me to call in with this question, and I want to say that I agree with what your guests were saying, that the Internet is a dangerous place, and I also think that Sue Hubbell's Book of Bees is a really, really good book. It's easy to get through for first-time beekeepers. But the question is how do you know when you need to requeen your colony? And when can you do that, and how do you know that it's time to replace the queen?
Well, I'll go first on this. One of the... Even before you look at a colony, and you're trying to judge whether it's time for a queen, just the timing. How old is the queen? You know, if you're onto your second year of a queen, then the chances are good that she's going to swarm, or they're going to swarm, and the chances are good that your colony would benefit by requeening. And for those non-beekeepers and beekeepers-to-be, when we can replace an older queen with a newer queen. Now, there's some, quite a few steps involved there, and it's fraught with all types of perils and dangerous areas, but it can be done. And it's an accepted beekeeping practice to requeen, and you don't necessarily have to kill your old queen, although Tom is saying off with her head, which is, you know, we off queens not infrequently, sometimes not on purpose. But so that's where I'll start this conversation, is that if it's an older queen, then it's... that it's worth looking at for requeening. Tom, yeah. On to Tom here. Okay.
Well, I was just going to say for Paul's question on timing, is that, you know, generally you don't want to wait too long into the season, and you don't want to do it necessarily in the middle of a nectar flow, because there's a delay that happens. So one of the things that I think you and I try to do, Glenn, is that we look at the, you know, midsummer requeening for, you know, they're not a whole lot of work on these bees when they're going into the fall.
You know, one thing you mentioned there for requeening, and one we might want to think about it, is at a time when our mite load is very high. I mean, this is a little bit beyond beginning beekeeping, but, you know, one of the biggest pest, I will say, the problem with beekeeping bees is the varroa mite, a parasitic mite, varroa mite. And one way that we can mitigate its effects is to have a queenless or an eggless period, a broodless period. And one way to do that is to have a queenless period. So either to cage a queen or to requeen, but don't put her in for, or confine her for 2 or 3 weeks. You know, you can do that maybe the end of June or in July when the nectar flow is waning anyway. So
that's a good idea.
Tom.
Paul, what a great question. And it brings up one of the important aspects of learning about bee husbandry. What one has to do in learning to keep bees is first learn the life cycle of the bee, and that brings up the question of how old the queen is. You learn about in the life cycle of the colony itself, and so when to requeen. But then you learn what to look for when you open up a hive. You learn to manipulate, and you learn what to look for. And then you begin over time to learn what to do as a follow-on to what you see. And so what I would look at is, what is the laying pattern of the queen? How good does the pupae, the bees go through complete metamorphosis, so their eggs and larvae and pupa. So how good does that look? Is that queen laying well? What are their other signs of disease? And then other issues. A common approach to those who keep bees in urban areas, and sometimes in rural areas too, as a way to discourage swarming, is to replace the queen every year.
Mm-hmm.
And
which is important for particularly for city beekeeping.
It's extremely important. And so anyhow, that's a great question, both in its complexity and its subtlety, and it's an opportunity to sort of discuss some of the aspects of keeping bees.
Right, and it gives a new beekeeper a hint of what's to come.
How difficult it is.
Right. You know, one thing that you mentioned there, you know, that we can manipulate the bees here, and I think that the beekeepers get a bum rap when they say, well, you know, you're in there manipulating your bees. And what I like to do is to, we'll say, well, what about for, you know, cattle or horses? You know, you're keeping cattle or horses. And you don't just let them go out and eat on, you know, one pasture at all the time. You actually manipulate where those cattle go to eat. You'll keep one pasture fenced off so it can grow nice and lush, and at the same time you won't let them trample down another part of a pasture. So that's manipulating. So maybe we need another word that, you know, that when we talk about when we're going into the hive and manipulating it.
Well, we use the term work our bees.
Yes, right. And so we're not necessarily manipulating them like we're you might manipulate a human or something like that. So anyway, I'm going to think about a word that might.
Something more than manipulative.
Yes. Yes. So, okay. Well, that's a good question. If you have any other, you know, beekeeping questions on, you know, where to go, how to start, and we'll talk about that. He's long gone. Okay. But any other listeners have questions, 503-231-8187, and we'll forge ahead here. On the... when I was talking to Joe, who's the president of Portland Metro, mentioned that you were going to try to have more field days this year. You want to talk about that a bit?
Sure. Last year we had three or four field days, and we're going to, or three field days, I think, and we're going to have some more. In addition, I want to mention that Portland Metro sponsors Bee Day, which is open to the general public and has participants from all of the all three of the beekeeping organizations in the Portland area, and some people came up last year from Salem, and it's out at a commercial beekeepers location out in Colton.
Mm-hmm. Outside of Malala.
Malala, and it's usually held toward the end of April, and it's a day where the public can come out and look at beehives. They have veils, and they can see how we work or manipulate the hives. Get a real feel for that. But for our members, we have some Saturday workshops planned for this year. They're going to be equipment assembly workshops. We're going to be some swarm prevention, mite testing, mite treatment. I think that we might have another small-scale queen rearing workshop as we did last year. So the idea of, and I think all the beekeeping clubs do this, it's beekeeping is something that you acquire the knowledge of through doing, and by mutually supporting one another, then we can help us all to have more success in keeping bees so that we can become beekeepers instead of beehavers. It would be extremely, extremely difficult to learn beekeeping on one's own. You really need mm-hmm. to learn with people, both with other people and from people.
I totally agree, Tom. I think the best and most informative way to start learning is to work with other beekeepers, and preferably somebody that's been doing it for a while, which is part of the reason I kind of hitched my wagon to Mr. Andreessen here. We too are also doing some various things in education. We're really
This is the Portland Urban Beekeepers.
Portland Urban Beekeepers. Mm-hmm. And by the way, you can find us. We meet the first Wednesday of every month over at Calaroga Terrace Retirement Community in the auditorium there at first Wednesday of every month, and that's at 1400 Northeast 2nd Avenue. But we are also doing some basic, besides the education class that we're doing, that Glenn, that you're going to be instructor for, we're going to be doing some visits. Ours are urban-based, so, you know, we instead of going out, we don't have the bee day at a commercial commercial operation. Ours will be into urban apiaries, you know, where there's some backyard setups, maybe similar to what you and I are doing. Those are scheduled, and we also have one of the main things that we're trying to work on right now is our plant team committee, and this is something that we're working with on other organizations, including the Sabin community, the Sabin neighborhood community, and other communities around the city of Portland. This idea is that it's like you were saying earlier, Glenn, it's the other side of beekeeping. It's a really important piece of it, as you know. Glenn does a pollen and nectar report in our monthly meeting every month, and that's kind of unique. I don't know too many other clubs that do that, but it's done well, and really appreciate that, because we know, as you said at our last meeting, there's something growing for the bees almost every month of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing that we're doing a lot more work on this year and the coming year.
And that's a way that our listeners can get involved, even if they're not keeping bees, and that's to plant
exactly
more bee-friendly plants.
Yeah, and a lot of people say that. Look, I don't necessarily want to work with bees, but I want to do whatever I can in my yard to help. So we encourage them to, we have a list of plants and everything, and we try to encourage them to put in bee-friendly plants.
Okay, well, let's take our second break here, and I'm not even going to announce who this is. This is kind of the first garden stumper. Who is this? Who's playing here? I'll give you a hint. It's from 1972. Then you'll see if you can identify this. And then we'll come back with the stumper, the plant of the month, and more beekeeping talk. This is The Dirtbag. Well, I've stumped the panel here in the air room here.
I think it was Pavarotti.
But. Yeah. I thought that wasn't right.
I thought it might have been Peter Townsend, but it's not.
No. And as I said, this is the title track from this group's 13th album. So that means they put out a lot of albums. Yeah. All right, here it is. Drum roll. That's the Beach Boys.
You're kidding me.
No. Wild Honey.
Yeah, I would have never guessed that.
No. And you didn't.
That's right.
Still sounds like Pavarotti to me.
Yeah. Okay, we got to do some schooling here on Tom then.
Yeah.
Okay, then where are we at here? Well, let's before we go to the garden stumper, let's talk about the plant of the month here. Get my reading glasses on here for this. And I learned some stuff about doing the research on this the Mahonia Arthur Menzies, and I'd always thought it was kind of a some kind of a cultivar of our native Oregon grape, and but it's not. But it's a Mahonia, and our native is the Mahonia aquifolium, and this is there's several types of these winter blooming Oregon or Mahonias. We'll just have to call them that. And this is the cross Mahonia by Media, are hybrids between Mahonia japonica, japonica meaning Japan or at least Asian, and then Mahonia lomorifolia, lomorifolia, or something
like
that.
Say it one more time.
Lomorifolia.
That's great.
Yeah. And the one that I'm growing is Arthur Menzies, and it's blooming now. The spikes of yellow flowers have opened up, and yesterday when it was warmer and not raining, I indeed noticed honeybees visiting this plant. There are others. One is called Charity, and another is called Winter Sun, and they're all have yellow spikes, and they can get pretty tall. Mine now is probably 8 to 9 feet tall, and it's not quite that wide. I've pruned it back a little bit, but it's just got these beautiful yellow spikes of blooms, and the leaves are very spiky too. If you walk by them, you're not going to be sneaking through these anyway, so wear gloves when you're pruning them. But you can plant these Mahonias. There's another variety that I found in my research here, Mahonia urebractita.
Would you say that again, please?
No.
One shot on that one.
Yeah. And it's an October-November flowering Mahonia. And then if we go to our March-blooming Mahonias, the Mahonia aquifolium, we can have about 6 months of Mahonia nectar.
Man.
And that would be remarkably
incredible.
Appropriate for honeybees, because honeybees don't hibernate, we learn. Whenever it's warm enough, they're out foraging and, well, defecating.
Well, one of the things that it also brings up is that all beekeeping is local, because the each area has its own season of nectar flows, and depends on what plants are in bloom, and what plants that are in bloom that honeybees actually can work, that they can get their nectar and honey from. So it's much different here in Oregon than it was in Klamath Falls, where I've kept bees. In Klamath Falls and both in Portland are much different than San Francisco. So
yeah, that's
even
right.
Microclimates across the Portland area, beekeeping's different here than it is in the foothills.
Yeah, or at up on Council Crest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
for example, winds would be different, the elevation's different. And did you have something to say?
No, I was just going to ask. I was going to ask what the stumper was.
Oh, well, it is time for the stumper. Let's have our theme here, and we'll just do it right for once here. Okay, keeping with the theme of the day, beekeeping and bees, the question is, a short, simple one, what do bee larvae eat? And we're getting kind of technical here. So what do bee larvae eat? All right, if you know the answer to that, give us a call, 503-231-8187. We don't have any prizes for this. No, Tom is not eligible for the answer here.
I can step outside and call in on my cell phone. Would that count?
No.
No.
We would know. We know that you're not from these parts.
Because I don't have one of them funny Oregon accents.
That's right. Yours is smooth. And ours isn't. Okay, so what do bee larvae eat? That's pretty simple there. I mean, simple enough. Now, I did have another stumper that I thought was just interesting that had nothing to do with bees, but it had to do with plants. But it was too easy because these guys got it right away. But it is kind of interesting, so I'm just going to tell you what it is. I watched recently a NOVA program on misfit animals. I don't know if anybody else saw that, but it was, how these animals just don't fit in, or they're just weird.
Sounds like my in-laws, my ex-in-laws.
Okay, not going any further than that. But so the question had something to do, well, what animal gets 99% of its diet nutrients, or no, it's what 99% of its diet is from just one single plant. So what is the animal and what is the plant? Well, these guys got it right away. Tim said, well, it must be the panda bear and bamboo, which is right. And then I went on to talk about, well, what makes it a misfit then? Well, most bears, maybe all other bears, are carnivorous and not the panda. It's herbivore. Right. All other bears, apparently, hibernate. Not the panda bear, because it needs to keep eating because there's so little nutritive value in that. And it had some good video, and this panda bear foraging in a frozen forest, you know, snow, and it would wrap the leaves of the panda around its of the bamboo around its nose 4 or 5 times, circling it, and that would break up the ice so it could eat it. And there is so little nutritive value in bamboo that these bears defecate about 40 times a day because they're just eating so much. what's that called? Forage. Yeah. Tammy says, thanks for that image.
Yeah, and it reminds me of my ex-brother-in-law.
Well, I can understand why it's your ex, then, I guess. Yeah, that wasn't a good situation, apparently. Okay, well, we're still looking for the answer to what do bee larvae eat, 503-231-8187. And that's also the question, the number to call if you have a question about bees. Now, I wanted to mention here, or I'll go back to this, the plant propagation, not plant, the, what are we calling it, the plant team?
Plant team, yeah.
Plant team.
We're working on a better name.
If you have a better name for that, call us, too.
Yeah, please do.
But one of the things that we are, that you will be guaranteed for, is that these plants that we recommend, we being the Portland Urban Beekeepers, will attract bees in Portland and in this area, Oregon, Western Oregon, we'll say. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, bee magazines will have articles on plants, and while they may attract bees in Michigan, it's not necessarily for sure that they'll attract them here. So these are proven honeybee plants. And if they attract honeybees, then it's likely that they will attract many of the other native bees that we have here. Mm-hmm. So we're doing our research on this. It'll be available. Hopefully, we'll have some seed packets available, maybe both annual and perennials.
Yes.
Seeds, and maybe even some starts.
Yeah.
We'll see about that.
Okay. Yeah, and we're like you were saying, the plants that what you and I do all summer long when we're watching our bees is we see a plant and look at the flower, and if there's a bee on it, are the bees visiting it? And you know, sometimes for instance, I think goldenrod, for example, is like, you know, it's always cited as one of the great bee plants, and you know, we just don't see, and it might be that it's in competition with another plant that's mm-hmm. even better at the same time. So, but, you know, what are the bees visiting?
Right. And that's what makes all the difference in the world there. Okay. Why don't we talk about... Oh, we do have a phone call. Okay. Greg, do you have a question or an answer for us?
Well, I don't know if I have the answer, but I think I saw on a documentary somewhere that bees cultivate some kind of a fungus that the drones... cultivate some kind of a fungus that they give to the larva. Is that correct?
Well, you're kind of beating around the answer, but it's not right. It's not drones. We can just that part's out of it. But the workers do something.
Other workers.
Yeah, and I guess if you get rid of if you replace the workers with drones, I'd say, well, the other way around. If it's the workers that something.
I didn't know the correct terminology. I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. You could have just said the bees.
The worker bees, I saw something, some kind of documentary or something, where some kind of bees cultivated, the worker bees cultivated something that they gave to the larvae that they ate.
Well, I think we're all nodding that, you've got you've got the right idea there. I mean,
I don't know if it's true of honeybees, though.
It is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is?
Yeah. You know, bees collect two different things for food. We'll just narrow it down to that.
I thought bees just ate pollen, period.
Yeah. Well, that's why this is an interesting question. Uh-huh. So the bees collect two different things for food. The nectar, which they will eventually make into honey. And then they collect pollen for its protein value, its fat value, its minerals. These are all nutrients that are in that.
Yeah.
But they don't feed pollen directly to larvae. And this is where another interesting part comes in. So the bees will collect pollen, bring it back to the colony. They'll pack it into a cell. And then, this is where you're thinking, this is where you got the right idea. They will add, mostly it's bacteria. Tom, I don't know if there's yeast, I think, involved there too.
Yes,
maybe not fungus per se.
Right.
Uh-huh. And it actually ferments the pollen. And that does a couple of things. One, it stores it longer. Just like we would make sauerkraut to preserve, what is it, cabbage?
Yeah, cabbage.
Yeah, or pickles or whatever. You know, it preserves it. It'll last longer. And another reason is that it breaks down the cell walls of the pollen, which are very tough to be dissolved by even human guts. I mean, it takes a lot. You know, you eat pollen and you're not getting too much value from it that way. And then Tom, help me out on this, or Tim, that they will feed some of that to maybe older larvae, but mostly what the nurse bees, as we call them, will eat this mixture. We call it bee bread.
Bee bread, yes.
At that point. Or actually, it might be called bee pollen at that point. And after they eat it, they have glands in their heads, which will convert it to a kind of a white, milky, yogurty type material. And they will feed that to these larvae. And the larvae, actually, they don't feed it to the larva. The larva feed themselves, but they put it into the cell, and the larva just almost floats in this. And it grows exponentially, almost 1,000 times from a little tiny larva to, size of a bee, essentially.
That's a really complicated process. That's a multi-step process.
Right. And one of the problem, and one of the theories, and I think that it has good merit for the cause of bee die-offs, is that while fungicides may not, or antibacterials may not, antibiotics, may not kill a bee outright. You know, you spray a fungicide on a bee and it walks away because that's not a problem. But how does that affect the fermentation of the pollen? You know, does it kill off the bacteria that are fermenting the food for the larvae?
Oh yeah.
And then they get fed not only the not completely fermented pollen, but they get fed the pesticide itself too, the fungicide.
So I think that
certainly figures into it.
Oh yeah.
But that's the story of how a larva grows.
That's great.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't.
I didn't know that. It's been a while since I vaguely remembered them cultivating something. I didn't know exactly what it was, but I didn't realize that I didn't remember that it was that multi-step of a process.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing. That's amazing.
Well,
a lot of chemistry.
Indeed. And, you know, to be a beekeeper, you know, you are a chemist, you're a nutritionist, you're a meteorologist, you're a woodworker, you're a marketer.
A botanist.
Yes. A horticulturalist.
Amazing. Yeah.
Wow.
So.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much.
You bet. You bet. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, it's a good question. It brought up, again, it gave an intimation of just how complex and all of the issues that are involved with keeping bees, and how we husband them. How do we mm-hmm. make sure? How do we evaluate how they're doing? How do we follow their development through the season? How do we deal with the diseases they might have?
It's a tough row to hoe to keep bees in Western Oregon. Oregon in general, really, because, well, for one, you know, honeybees aren't native to North America or the Western Hemisphere, or the North America, we'll say.
Well, neither are we Europeans.
So. Yeah, right. And then you couple that with diseases that they're not used to, and pests and all sorts of maladies, and it's just, and then throw in climate change and
pesticides.
Yeah.
And also, one of the things that's interesting, there's a kind of a cliche among in the beekeeping community that if you ask four beekeepers a question, you'll get four different answers. And the idea is that, again, we're trying to keep the, or maybe more than four answers.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to keep these wild animals, and the ways to do that are many. And so there are many, so we each of us has his or her own approach to how to do that. And many of them work well. What sometimes gets to be tedious is I run into particularly more beginning beekeepers who know the truth with a capital T mm-hmm. about how to do that. And it's not. We all kind of have to muddle along. We have some basic principles, and then we muddle along. And if we pay attention and if we think about what we're doing, then maybe we can keep our hives or most of our hives alive. But it's far from a settled law yeah. about how to do that.
And I think that's an interesting part of beekeeping, or that everybody will learn from everybody, but then we all go on our own path.
Exactly. You know, I know you're wrong in many ways about keeping bees, and well, that's so is Tim. I'm the only one that's really right about how to do this.
I say that the other way around. I said the only thing that Tom and Tim can agree on is that I'm doing it wrong.
Yeah, that's probably about right. The only time somebody's right is when he or she is offered to help me move a hive. See,
yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
You forgot about the other characteristic that we have to have is the ability to lift boxes up, because they can be fairly heavy.
Yeah, the only thing light about honey is its color.
That's good. I hadn't heard that.
So we'll come back and talk about maybe some different bee boxes. You know, that seems to be some interest, and what we say may surprise you. So we'll come back after our third musical break here, kind of an old standard from Albert Collins. Honey Hush. Doesn't have anything to do with bees, but it's honey anyway. It's a good tune anyway. We were having a little discussion here about, we would like to, before we talk about some domiciles for bees, to mention just a few key bee plants, you know, what to be thinking about.
Yeah, that's, well, one of the things that I said earlier is that, you know, you don't have to be a beekeeper to help the bees and all the other pollinators. And, you know, there's a Marla Spivak, who was at our conference this year, I think it's just does some wonderful research. She says when bees have access to good nutrition, they are better able to engage their own natural defenses. And you know, there is some science starting to come around. Some of it coming from Oregon State University, where they're saying that having a variety of these pollens and nectars that we were just talking about are, just like with humans, are important to the bees having their best chance available to, you know, when they're feeding the young. And so, what we're trying to do, and one of our projects, Glenn, we're working with an organization to expand in, a couple of hundred acres of where there's just weeds. We're trying to find some plants that are good for pollinators. And so people generally ask, well, what are some good plants? You know, and I think we have some favorites that we like, that, and we try to mm-hmm. think about the season, because everything's in bloom in June. And that happens to be one of our biggest nectar flows in the Willamette Valley is the blackberry. But what else? And what are they going to do for the rest of the summer? And so I've just got a few here.
Yeah, go ahead and list those.
Douglas aster, which I think is native plant. Mm-hmm. Phacelia, and you also mentioned native meadow foam. I can't think of the botanical name for that, but...
I can't either.
But that would be one. Globe thistle. Sedums mix, clovers, and people sometimes put in ground covers for their little backyard gardens. You know, there's a variety of things the bees can use if you let some of those cover crops grow and go to seed.
You know, one other thing, Tim, I want you to just quickly mention is about the change of permitting requirements for the city of Portland, briefly.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, we just recently, I've been working with the city of Portland and to some degree the city of Gresham on the notification process. And what we have done with Multnomah County, I believe, and we're going to find out here sometime in the next few weeks, I think there's going to be a proposal given to us from the Multnomah County, who are the ones that enforce the beekeeping ordinance for the city of Portland ordinance. Is that in the past it's been signatures required by neighbors of 150 feet of your property line. And now it looks like they're going to be changing that to make it just notification, and there will no longer be signatures required, which is a big plus for a lot of people.
Because, that's right. Yeah, there'll be some other changes too, probably, but stay tuned. I'll try to have an update on that next month.
Great.
On the dirt bag there too. So. Okay, Thomas, we got time for a quick question.
Yeah, okay. You've gone into great detail about the small scale beekeeping, but I'm wondering if you could mention some of the differences as to how the big honey manufacturers manage their bees. Like there's all this sustainable and free range thing when it comes to cows and chickens and all that stuff versus the big factory farms. Can you make some comments about the bigger factory type operations for honey? And I'll listen on my radio. Thank you.
Well, that's a tough one. The commercial guys, the ones that we're mostly familiar with are family-run organizations. They tend to treat their colonies much more than the... I don't think they treat them more. They just treat their colonies, unlike many of the Portland beekeepers, but they do it responsibly. They follow the directions and do it right. And the commercial beekeepers actually have fewer dead colonies than backyard beekeepers that don't treat.
And it's a continuum of beekeeping. There's the hobbyist, and then there's the sideliners who have maybe a few dozen to 100 colonies, and then there's the commercial guys. And so there's not, and each, as with the small people, there's different ways of keeping bees.
That's right. We're running out of time here, so I'm sorry that we can't have a fuller answer to that. In fact, we are out of time. So, Tom Chester with you're with both organizations, the Portland Metro Association, and Tim Wessels with the Portland Urban Beekeepers. You can find both of those online through the orsba.org, or just search for those. And there's lots of opportunities to learn and to observe and to be involved.
Come on out the second Thursday of the month to PMBA meeting at Clackamas Community College.
And come on to the first Wednesday of the month to the Portland Urban Beekeepers at Calaroga Terrace.
Thank you both. Well, I'll be back next month with Jim. Jim got the month off today. This is Glenn Andreessen. Thanks for listening. Be well and have a super solstice.
Okay, it's noon. Time for the KBOO Noon News coming right up. But we have, before we go to that, we have a clarification about a website that was mentioned a long time ago around 9 o'clock this morning during the interview about the Portland Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines. The website for that committee is www.portlandchrp.com, portlandchrp.com. Okay, sorry about that. Thank you very much. Here comes the Wednesday noon news are coming up soon, and then Nick Geffro with Jazz Lives.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, December 10th, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, more than 150 people were arrested in California as demonstrations continued for a fourth consecutive night in Berkeley over the actions of police in notable high-profile cases. Protests occurred Monday night in California over police killings that failed to result in charges in the Michael Brown and Eric Gardner cases. Police were pelted with rocks and other projectiles as demonstrators sought to disrupt major rail and highway traffic.
Billionaire Paul Allen plans to donate $100 million for improving disease research